Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Borzoi Bosovitz back on the show. Of course, should you go by John Borzoi Chapman or Borzoi Bosovitz? Which is it here?
You can just call me Borzoi. I mean, in fact,
Borzoi,
actually,
okay.
that's why we when Antelope Hill released my book, we thought it'd probably be a good idea to put the name Borzoi on there so people knew exactly what they were getting, because the number of pseudonyms kind of confuses people. In fact, actually, I decided to, and if you read the preface, I actually put all three pseudonyms on there of Ed Chang, John Chapman, and Borzoi Boscovich on there, because the John Chapman thing confuses a lot of people. In fact, some people thought I had doxxed myself. Maybe I did, who knows? But
Yeah.
some people thought I had doxxed myself with that name because, well, it just suddenly I was writing under this name. Well, the story behind that, I've told it in other places, but I'll tell it here because not everyone's heard the story. The story behind the John Chapman name is when American Sun started, Nick Mason asked me to contribute some pieces to it, and he said, "You got to use a." I think they ended up moving away from this eventually, just because it became too difficult to corral all their different writers. But because I was one of the first writers they asked, Nick said, "We want you to have a real sounding name." And so we were spitballing different things, and given the title American Sun, and there's this kind of this calling to an American tradition, I said, I'll just call myself John Chapman, because that was the name of Johnny Appleseed."
Okay.
And as a Midwest, yeah, a lot of people don't know this, that Johnny Appleseed was an actual person as well.
Yes.
He was a member of the Swedenborgian Church as well. Very unusual, interesting figure. Some of the stuff about him is in the realm of folklore, but because I'm from the Midwest, I've always had a soft spot in my heart for Johnny Appleseed. So we
Oh,
because they do
okay.
they do teach him Midwestern kids, especially those in Michigan and Ohio, about him and what he did, kind of going across the new territories, planting seeds and all that. Well, actually, mostly planted saplings, but planting trees. So.
Yeah, I remember learning about him in grade school. They probably don't learn about that stuff anymore, kids.
Now, I know as of the aughts, because I used to help teach kids, so I know. In the aughts, at least a couple people were still teaching it. I doubt they're still doing it. Who knows?
Yeah, now they're teaching critical race theory to second graders.
Oh God.
Yeah.
So yeah, one of many reasons why my soon-to-be son will be homeschooled.
Yes, one of many. Now, yeah. So, of course, you come back. You've since your last visit here, you've published a book, "Cultured Grugs: Dispatches from America in Collapse." An uplifting title.
Yeah, we kicked around a couple of different subtitles for it, and eventually I just kind of went with that because I didn't really know what else to say, how else to describe it.
Yeah, all things considered, collapse, decline, it may not be a bad thing. Who knows how this plays out? But you've of course, basically, it's a grouping or a collection of various essays that you've written, and also a four or five new essays that you read at the end, correct?
Yeah. There's
Okay.
some are there's a couple of them. There's at least one where it's kind of like a non-essay, because I think it's even less. It's less than 1,000 words long. It's one of my shorter works, and it's not. It's an idea that I wanted to extrapolate on, but I didn't have time to do so. But for the most part, yeah, that's right. The new essays have some previously published stuff, like the so for example, there's the Lewis and Hitler essay, which was in for Wyndham Lewis's book Hitler. I included that. There's a short story that I include that was originally published in Ending Bigley. So outside of those, it's like one, two, three, four, five, six, yeah, like six new essays.
Okay. So, this book, how would you describe it to our listeners? I read about 85, 90% of it. I think I might have missed an article too, but I'll let you describe it.
So it's a collection of essays would be the easiest way of explaining it. For people who are familiar with my work, a lot of the content is not going to be new, although as I found out, and I'm not really surprised by this, a lot of people never read my Race Boars articles. Race Boars is a personal blog that I sometimes write in. A lot of people had read the American Sun stuff, so for some people it might be about 50% new content for them. But anyways, I would say that this book gives a pretty good picture of a developing post-Trump idea of how to look forward towards the future. Because if you read it chronologically, you can actually start to see the different ways some of my ideas or beliefs started to evolve or change. I think there might even be some parts where some ideas contradict each other, just because it's the last, from 2018 to 2021 was a huge learning process for me of exploring different ideas, reading different things. It was a big awakening period for me. And so I guess the easiest way of summing it up is, okay, the Trump moment is over. What next? And unfortunately, I don't really provide an answer on that. I know people wanted to see a handbook for dissidents, and maybe one day I will write that after I have a better idea of how to be a better dissident. But as a way, it's just an attempt to let's take a look at the situation at hand, and let's examine it from every possible angle, and let's see if we can get a better picture of this, especially in the current state of America and where things are going to go. The best encapsulation of that probably is, and it's one of my most famous essays, is the Piss Earth essay.
Yeah. That's where basically you write about they hate everything. They hate your kids. Hate you. They want to ruin you. They want to humiliate you. They want to ruin your kids, rape your kids.
I would also say this book, and this is the reason why I put this quote at the very start of it. There's a quote from Studies in Classic American Literature by D.H. Lawrence. It's from his first Melville essays. He's got two in the book. We have struggled on and on. We must still go. We may have to smash things, then let us smash. And our road may have to take a great swerve that seems like a retrogression, but we can't go back. And I think that encapsulates what this book is about, is that there's nothing we can go back to, but there is something we can build towards. So let's figure out what that is.
And that's where I think the Pequot, the doomed ship in Moby Dick, is sort of a stand-in for the United States.
Oh yeah, I mean that's D.H. Lawrence saw it exactly as that, and saw it as a symbol of the white race. If in his more famous, so like I said, there's two Melville essays. The more famous one is the Moby Dick essay, and he talks about Melville in that, but he also talks about the Pequot representing the doom of the white race. Nick Mason, actually, you know, friend of the show here, friend of both of our shows, I've cribbed this talking point from him, but I think it's a fantastic reading of Moby Dick. He's described Moby Dick as the encapsulation, basically, of what America used to kind of – what the original – what old America was. And it was a ship full of a ship of colored savages following insane white Quakers on tragic and doomed quests.
Yeah. Yeah, chasing the white whale.
Chasing whiteness itself.
Yeah. That article, Piss Earth, it just shows you. Well, at least it sort of makes sense of sort of the clown world that we inhabit today. With, people are at a loss to explain what they're witnessing. Your typical, normie or your boomer, your typical boomers understanding things, they're at a loss to explain the sort of sudden shift. You said between 2018 and now, there's been a sharp learning curve. Right? Yeah.
2025 was a bit optimistic.
Yes, exactly.
Well, the reason for that title, so a lot of people don't know the origin of that meme either. I don't even know where the original meme came from, who made this thing, but there's this absurdist meme that basically supposed to be like out of the mouth of babes, you know, like, oh, we like kids say the darndest things type thing.
Yeah.
And the last one is this kid that says something to the effect of bomb every jungle, the world is a toilet. Piss Earth 2025. I do not give a single frick. Something like that. It's very absurdist humor. And so the idea that me and my friends came up with is that you know, on the assumption that Trump was going to win a second term, is that after Trump was gone, we would be entering into piss earth in 2025. Mm-hmm. And that was what the where the origin of it was. But as we said, that was an optimistic optimistic timetable there. I would argue we're probably in it now. But the idea was to contrast it with an old meme from like 2019, is, you know, clown world, that it just everything about the situation is just very clownish and you can only point and laugh at it. And that was at a time when it seemed like there was a way to work within politics, but you were stymied at every turn and you could point and laugh at it. But now it's dangerous to point and laugh at it. That's what Piss Earth encapsulates, is that we shoot at the clowns and now you better watch what you say. Otherwise, you're going to get a lot of trouble. And unfortunately, normies they have trouble grasping that because they're still stuck in this mode of like talking about, oh, the political correctness out of control and crazy SJWs. Well, they're in power and they're going to punish you, and they are punishing you, and people are grasping at understanding that.
Yeah, it's identifying behind the craziness is a well-organized malevolence, which this is something that Christopher Caldwell wrote about in his book, Age of Entitlement. About through the late 80s and 90s, even the aughts, there was this, you know, the right would laugh at some of the lunacy of the left and political correctness, which was really just cultural Marxists, you know, continuing their march in their conquest through the institutions. And it wasn't just education, it was the corporations. And behind them was this same malevolent force, international finance, whatever, you know, cosmopolitans, whatever you want to call it. But, is why they're being laughed at. They were seizing all the positions of power, cultural and economic, and therefore political power in the country. And now you can't just laugh at them now, because you can laugh at them, and then pretty soon you'll be hauled before your human resource, you know, department, and you'll be fired, you know, for online posting or what you've said or what you didn't say. And it's gotten that bad. And again, the thing is, with Piss Earth, it's recognizing that there's a malevolent force out there that really hates you. And you have to act on that assumption now if you want to protect your family, your community, you know, and you know, your country, what remains of it.
Yeah. And I always wonder to what extent people can send my stuff to other people to help them understand this. As a writer can never be a good judge of his own work, but the one thing I've always wanted to really make sure I'm able to do is explain this to people who don't understand the mechanics of what's going on. Because the average person knows something's wrong. The average person can, on that animal level, intuit there's a hostile force that's against me for some inexplicable reason. In fact, actually, they often get very confused. It's like, well, why do they hate me so much? What did I do? I don't understand. They struggle to understand the actual mechanics. Well, not only do they struggle to understand the actual mechanics of it, they often have trouble even conceiving there are actual mechanics. And as you said, there is a number of organizations with purpose that are doing this intentionally, and it's not because they're just crazy and out of control. They are very deliberate in what they do, and because that the whole system is basically based around cloaking what it does and what its motives are and what its techniques are, the average person struggles to even see it for what it is. So how do you explain that to people? That's something that a talented writer has to try and figure out and do. And that's what I've been trying to figure out to do. I have some success with cluing people in. Sometimes it's just, you know, it's whatever the person. People come at this stuff in weird, in their own angles and at their own ways. And so sometimes you can't always plan out and predict how it's gonna, you know, come across to them. But
yeah, and it's difficult because pointing out, you know, the mechanics of this cultural revolution, if you will, of this coup, cultural coup or revolution, and is you have to name names and organizations, and sometimes those organizations, those names are members of a protected elite class, and people have been trained, sort of have a gut reaction or knee jerk reaction to said criticism. Like if you point out Jewish organizations, the prominent role of the Jewish organizations, called organized Jewry or Jewish power If you want to distinguish it from, like, because often people misconstrue you saying that every Jew, it's a Jewish conspiracy. Well, in a way, it is, because these are Jewish organizations, the same way that it was a German plot to invade Poland, or a German plan to attack, or a Japanese plan to attack Pearl Harbor. Not every German, not every Japanese engaged in those attacks, but nevertheless, we use these terms, these general terms, to explain the situation, or explain what happened. And there was, like I said, there was a political entity called the German government, which represented the German people, the Third Reich, and there was a German Japanese government, which represented the Japanese people, for better or for worse. And so, the same thing that we apply to these organizations, whether it's AIPAC, or the presidents of what's it was the presidents, the leaders of greater Jewish organizations, or the Jewish Agency, or whatever, the Mossad,
Well,
Israel,
and it
so.
seems for a lot of people, they once you broach these ideas with them a lot, I mean, there's going to be a lot of programming and education you have to basically, or miseducation, I should say, that you have to undo. And some of the things that you'll hear when you're talking to them is that, well, they'll point out, oh, well, like that they have a Jewish friend or something. And but when if you get them to even think about the oligarchs, the idea that an oligarch, or the elites, or whatever you want, what term you want to use, have an essential nature to them, such as an ethnicity, it's you can it some people do struggle with trying to conceive that, because they've been told to kind of see them as this almost just this strange force, this strange supernatural force, or they're just people. But going back to the example of like the Jewish friend, like, yeah, your Jewish friend may not be the person who's actively working to destroy you, but you know what? He benefits from the people who are actively working to destroy you. I mean, the average person is downstream from what their advocacy groups do.
And a good example is I've just I think 7 of 8 Ivy League schools, their presidents are Jewish now.
Oh, clearly they got this through merit.
And you find out that of course the way presidents are chosen is through a donor list, and there's the donor the large donations are from Jews now. So these formerly WASP institutions have become Jewish organizations. This came out because there's been these lawsuits against Harvard regarding affirmative action and how they have quotas against Asians, particularly East Asians, from being accepted in these universities. They're underrepresented, and of course other groups are highly overrepresented. One thing would be Jews, and so there is a but at the same time, you recently, past couple weeks, you had this anti-Asian hate thing just pop out of nowhere, where it became violence against Asians became a symptom or an attribute of white supremacy, despite the fact that the anti-Asian hate is mostly, or the crimes they call anti-Asian hate, are being perpetrated by black people, particularly black young black men. But nevertheless, it became something about white supremacy.
The sudden focus on it has to be so perplexing to the
Yes.
average person, because the way that the media cycle operates, you have to be over socialized to be able to turn on a dime and to respond to it in real time, like the way that they expect you to. And I mean, I don't watch the news, so I may not be the best judge of how people are reacting to this, but it just seems to me very perplexing with the way that they suddenly focused on this. Now, I mean, I understand why they're doing it, because they're trying to set up the whole, dialectic and false dichotomy of basically getting people to focus on the. It actually serves both purposes of focusing on this ostensible Asian hate by activating the people who want nothing but race politics, anti-white race politics, and then also activates the people who are on the more conservative side and hate China and want to see the Chinese behind every possible thing that's happening in the United States right now. That's not to say the Chinese aren't doing something, but it's just so clear to me that they're trying to activate both of these that currents going on in the United States, and getting people to not talk about anything that I think is a little bit more relevant. But the way that they suddenly went all in on this Asian hate thing, just it's just perplexing to me. I just don't think the average person can turn on a dime like that, but maybe I'm mistaken.
Well, yeah, basically, how they create the sort of the, remember how the white supremacy meme came out of, like, Well, it's not out of nowhere, but the fact that the in the fall you had the Department of Homeland Security and the National Security Agency writing these reports somehow white terrorism, white supremacy is the number one domestic threat. Like what? And then you have the incident at the Capitol Hill on January 6th, where you had the protests, the rally on behalf of Donald Trump or against election fraud, and then you had a crowd that gained access, largely let into the Capitol, and it was then morphed into a riot by the media because there were some altercations up there. Then it became a white supremacy riot, insurrection,
Oh, yeah.
sedition, and people are looking at. There's no evidence or to justify this. But nevertheless, the FBI and the federal government are going, full speed ahead and trying to, put people in prison for 20 years just for trespassing, and arguably not even trespassing because you have videotapes of the Capitol Police letting them in, kind of encouraging them, being drawn in. But then you have this sort of this out of nowhere anti-Asian hate thing being white supremacy. Then everyone knows that really most of the violence committed against Asians, with their convenience stores and all that, it's always black men, and that's the problem they most experienced. Then you had this incident down in Georgia, which
Oh, the spa shooting or
the spa in
the massage parlor
massage
shooting.
parlor, so it's sex trafficking or something going on,
Yeah.
and whole other dimension to which they ignore, but then it becomes anti-Asian hate on the part of white people, and it's like, again, back to this whole thing, white supremacy thing. So that seems to be the focus. But it's just one of these things where, there's one incident, then everyone, if there's one incident of a white guy committing a crime, it all of a sudden, all white people are to blame for it. So you have a situation where collective guilt really only applies to white people. If it's directed at any other group, it's racist. So when Asians act racist, they're acting white. When blacks attack Asians, it's because of white supremacy, and it's not supposed to make any sense because logic itself is a
Yeah,
relic of white supremacy.
they're also doing as well to hem in the Asians as well because they're creating because Asians within the United States since the white people are basically effectively blocked out of any powerful institution at this point. It's they have pretty thoroughly blocked us out. Asians still represent, however, a competing elite power block. I mean, Indians, for example, a lot of the focus has been on East Asians, but South Asians are rolled into that as well. I believe it's Indians that have the highest median income of any ethnic group within the United States right now.
Yeah,
And
if there
so.
is indeed a white supremacy structure, not only would we not be hearing about white supremacy as a problem because they would keep it, that power structure would prevent it from being discussed in the first place, but how is it that that Asians, yellow people or brown people, like subcontinent Asians, they have the highest income if there is
Yeah.
it's a guy, how does this occur, despite,
So this whole anti-Asian hate meme is also they're using this as a way to basically take control over any Asian advocacy organizations or any Asian would-be elites. They're trying to basically hem them in. You're starting to see the transformation they're trying to do on Asian people because the first generation and some of the second generation immigrants here know who's attacking them. They know what's they know they can see for themselves. They know who steals from them. They know who attacks them. But you do have these advocacy people and advocacy organizations that are slowly either being controlled by like these by second and third generation immigrants, especially mostly women who are very over-socialized, a lot of white boyfriends, of course, but very over-socialized and very hypersensitive to status and wanting to be, doing what power says, or they're just straight up, these mixed race, basically Jews. Like you have them trying to shape shift into a quasi Asian elite as well in order to hem that group in because they see them as a competing power block and a potential would-be elite in this country as well.
Yeah, it's funny because if you look at the anti-Asian hate thing, this is if you look at what's occurring at these Ivy League schools, is you have essentially that are now Jewish-run organizations like Harvard and Yale, openly discriminating against Asians, keeping them out, at the same time engaging in ethnic nepotism to have Jews overly represented in these institutions. So that's there. That's there for all to see. There's lawsuits about that. It's just that people aren't really aware that that Yale and Harvard have been taken over, by this one powerful, group. But that's there. But then you had then there's an attempt by the media. Like it was the New York Times. It was the New York Times that Korean immigrant.
Oh yeah, Sarah Jung.
Yeah, there's an example where she's hired by New York Times, which is a Jewish run newspaper. She's there to spread anti-white propaganda or rhetoric, whatever you want to call it, rhetoric or so she's doing her role. Again, you have a situation where these powerful institutions that have been essentially taken over. New York Times, I think, has always been Jewish, but these WASP institutions that have gradually been taken over. Now they're being utilized to keep them out of these positions, elite institutions. At the same time, then putting the blame on sort of this hapless white majority.
I hope that was a wake up, the Sarah Jung, because that was a couple of years ago. I hope that was a wake up call for some people because I know people. There were some on, I guess, like more normie or normie adjacent who were certain. Well, she can't say stuff like that. She's obviously going to get fired for that, and she was never. She never was. There was, enough of a backlash where it did seem like to some people that they might actually have to let her go. It's like, no, they'll write it out because that's what all they have to do. They make the news, so they know how the news cycle works. You just wait it out.
Yeah.
And eventually they'll move on to something else. That's how it works. One other thing I wanted to bring up on this whole thing about, them being a competing group for the Jews in this country. There's this documentary I saw a couple years ago called Searching for General So, which was basically about where did General So's chicken come from. But the most interesting thing that was within the documentary was how did every town in America end up with a Chinese restaurant? Well, what happened was you had these Chinese advocacy organizations very early on when Chinese immigration was a thing here, and they had maps of the entire United States, and they kept track of every town that how many Chinese restaurants does it have? Does it have this business? Does it have that business? They crunched the numbers on this stuff. So whenever new Chinese immigrants would come over, they actively found jobs for them. It's like, hey, this small town in the middle of Nebraska does not have a Chinese restaurant. You go move there with your family and set up shop there. Jews are aware of that. This is how they operate. And so they know, they understand that Asians, especially Chinese, do work in a very ethnocentric manner similar to them. So they understand this is a competing power source here. We have to make sure that they cannot become a rival to us, and we need to redirect them and use them as a cudgel against the white people in this country.
I mean, I've read long ago that Jews were known as the Jew. I mean, sorry, Chinese were known throughout East Asia as the Jews of the Orient.
Well, I still call them that. So
yeah, Malaysia and these areas that the traders and all that. But Chinese don't seem to be at least as overtly political or as devoted to sort of cultural or moral subversion as much as their Jewish counterparts.
Yeah, they just operate, I think, in what seems to be a more rational manner of, hey, we're going to go over there. We're going to accrue some power and prestige and some money. I mean, that's how you would think most people would operate. But I mean, Jews are just different. I mean, I know you know this because you've done the McDonald reading and all that. Mm-hmm. They are people who are very unique because they intentionally are. They are people who shall dwell alone. There is a certain separateness to them, and so it makes them operate in ways that I just don't think that are going to be intuitive or at least what we would perceive as rational to us. I'm a bit more of a bigot, so I've always viewed them. So since I became more cognizant of this, I just viewed them as basically a race of narcissistic sociopaths, and so they operate on that kind of lizard brain morality. Some people might object to that, but it's just having dealt with narcissistic personality disorder in people I know, I see the similarities. It's like this is the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, the Jewish revolutionary spirit, as E. Michael Jones calls it. This is, and I know Kevin MacDonald would have more of a evolutionary, so sort of a interpretation of it. I think both are kind of correct. They don't really conflict with one another. And I guess you could say it's a chicken or the egg type thing. I had a recent discussion, we're talking about Jewish power, and there's discussion that, you know, how much power do they have? Is it a international Jewish conspiracy? Well, I think historically there have been a lot of international Jewish conspiracies, but I think the mafia is about how do you think Israel was created? It didn't happen by accident. It depends what you're, you know, if you have an aversion to the term conspiracy. It's one of those things we've been one. I guess another example of us being sort of brainwashed or tricked into not thinking about seriously. You know, you're a conspiracy theorist, so it's supposed to, you know, shut down any critical thought. When conspiracy really is the organizing principle of the world, and all those in power do conspire. That's how they got into power, and so they stay in power. But
After God created the third caveman, the other two were in conspiracy against the third one. Conspiracies
exactly.
have been as old as time itself.
Yeah, and you know, even Plato talked about, you know, the shadows on the wall. Well, someone's tending the fire to create the shadows. You know, it takes human agency, you know, and planning.
I think some of these psychological for this is actually something I wanted to deeply explore in the book as well. Some of these psychological forces, I don't know if people quite understand how they're at play, which is why I have that long essay on humiliation, the Feast of Shame essay within the book, because I do genuinely believe that humiliation or the desire to humiliate one's enemies is more of a driving psychological force than people I think are willing to admit, especially I think for whatever reason Jews are have a deep desire to humiliate people, which is odd because I also view them as a people who are not capable of feeling shame. I've seen this as well with people who have had interactions with them and are perplexed how they don't seem they just you know you point out something they've done, they just kind of blink at you. They do not feel shame for anything they do, which is why they have no problem reveling in some of the more disgusting aspects of life itself. They just don't feel shame about it.
Well, this is their chief I guess character flaw would be chutzpah, and that's always known as kind of going too far. And but then they're in a position to interpret the reaction that benefits them, which is kind of a trend you see throughout history. And that's sort of the default position now is they're the perennial, you know, history's victims. And anything that bad ever happens, not only are they in a position to interpret the reaction and also to exaggerate it to serve their purposes. But there's ever any clear examination of what caused the reaction, whether it's in Poland or you know in the 16th or 17th century, or it's in Russia in the 19th century, or Germany in the 1930s. It's the interpretation of history is always a very self-serving interpretation, and since they've come to dominate, you know, both entertainment and media, that's the default position. That's the received view of things. Everyone has an internalized. I think maybe that's what Yuri Slezkind meant when he called it the Jewish century. You know, we see it through their lens now. And anyone looking to kind of deconstruct it or critique it, you know, kind of turn critique against them, has to go against a sort of a huge propaganda machine that has pretty much dominated the world for the past 80 years.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
you have to be able to kind of get into their OODA loop in order to be able to anticipate what they're going to do, because they are very good at getting under your skin, and you have to be able to know how to avoid letting them do that. Because I mean, they've had the levers of propaganda for quite some time, so they're well attuned to what can make people upset, cause them to make mistakes and to expose themselves. And so it requires a stronger than normal self-mastery to not let them do that to you. It's very difficult to be a dissident. That's part and parcel of what it means to be a dissident, is being able to get inside the system's OODA loop in order to just simply survive.
There was a sometimes when I talk about these matters with other people who aren't quite comfortable dealing with the Jewish question on these things, is sometimes they'll I've heard arguments that there's a tendency to overemphasize the Jewish role in these things, and or to see them at the sort of the ziggurat or the top of the pyramid, because historically Jews, powerful Jews, have been with the, you know, court Juden. And they were let into the inner court because they could loan money and for the benefit of the local prince or king, and they were engaged in certain commercial practices. They were excluded from traditional practices and all that. Although other people have written about how there've been vigorous attempts to try to include them in like agriculture and farming and traditional things to sort of change their behavior. In fact, I think even the early Zionist movement was aware of this fault in the Jewish people. They aggressively tried to get them into farming. That's what the whole kibbutz thing was about. But in Russia, there was an attempt right after Jewish emancipation when, to give them land and farming. They immediately reverted to their old ways. And
A lot of those early Zionist writers were frankly the writers and thinkers were frankly disgusted with the with what they saw in their own people.
yeah, some of the most anti-Semitic remarks are made by these people. It's like, well, who's writing this? Write this stuff.
I mean, like you look at the career of somebody like Joseph Trumpeldor, who's one of the early like one of the earliest Zionist war heroes, and you can only imagine him being disgusted with a lot of the nature of a lot of his co-ethnics. But at the thing I would just point this is, and I understand what you're saying, like people who have a certain level of Jew skepticism, which, I mean, I guess you could argue. I would say I have a nuanced position, but I mean, Joseph Trumpeldor would be disgusted at some of the things that his co-ethnics do. But at the end of the day, he fought for his co-ethnics.
Well,
So.
that's the point was there was E. Michael Jones had it was talking about the dispute over the statue of Louis the Ninth in St. Louis. He was the French king. He's a saint, Catholic saint, who ordered that the Talmud be burned. And apparently, this still bothers people.
Oh, when no, when yeah, I don't know if your listeners know this, but when Notre Dame burned a couple years ago, there were Jews that were celebrating it because of the disposition at Notre Dame,
Yes,
which was the burning of those Talmuds.
they don't forget. But this is how relevant this still is. And well, what happens is he's right now the people protesting outside Louis the Ninth are a bunch of Black Lives Matter activists. So why are they protesting Louis, St. Louis? Did he ever own slaves? This is a 13th century monarch. What's going on here? So he investigated further and found that, oh, there's a local synagogue behind agitating the black Muslim protesters. I think there was a Muslim guy who was leading the protesting. And of course, the city's name, St. Louis, is after him. So that's why there's a statue there, But so a bunch of Catholics come and rally on behalf of the statue, and there's a protest there and all that. But then through his investigations, he finds out that there was a woman rabbi there who's radical. She's the one causing agitation. So he contacts some conservative Jews in St. Louis to go, what's going on? And why don't you let's all come together and speak up against this rabbi? Because, well, yeah, she's a nut. No one listens to her. Well, let's have a press conference and speak up against her. He says, no, we don't want to do that. So the Jews wouldn't criticize the other Jew in this. So there you go. So then basically you're not you're basically supporting her but not actively opposing her. You're not going to go against your co-ethnic. So the higher principle is their ethnic identity, the fact that they're co-ethics, rather than the political philosophical principle.
And on this point as well that you brought up that because I do like this these like these devil's advocate conversations because I people who think we might people like me might be overdoing it as Jim Goad would call it. No, you can certainly overdo it and you definitely can. I mean, that's certainly the case, but fundamentally you have to understand that no matter what the problem is, because I look at things from like this is why I talk about the collapse stuff all the time, like. There are actually just systemic things, but the thing is, when you have a group of people who are that ethnocentric and that malevolent towards host populations, it doesn't matter if they are the prime mover of it or if they're not even the prime beneficiary of what they're doing. They're still, no matter what, and there's just no evidence against this. They're a force multiplier onto any problem you present. They may not be the cause of the problem, but they're there. You have to acknowledge they're there. You have to acknowledge the influence they have on it. They may not be the direct cause of it. There might be some nuance to it. That's fine, but they're still there, and you have to note that. You can't like run away from that. You can say, but what about the Chinese? Sure, I'll talk about the Chinese too. I have no, I don't have an ideology. I'm tribal oriented, and so everyone outside of my tribe is a potential enemy, and I'm going to examine how they may be my potential enemy. They may not be an enemy at that given moment. But if they're not my tribe, they're always a potential enemy then. You know, this is why it's why Carl Schmitt's very instructive for this, you know, friend-enemy distinction. You have to have a good, defined sense of that. Jew is not – Jews are not me. I am not Jews. There's not going to be – there's and so they're always a potential enemy. In fact, well, I mean, you know my opinions on that, so
– Well, as but, far back as the Converso crisis, that they their identity is we're all potential fifth columnists, and particularly with the Zionist state, because then you have the dual loyalty dispute and the fact that you know they're based on the ideology of Zionism is their primary loyalty is to the Zionist state, and Jonathan Pollard was is a good example of that. His Donald Trump's pardon of Jonathan Pollard, you know, is why was he pardoned? Well, because powerful Jews in America lobbied to get him pardoned. So American Jews, what mattered more to American Jews was the fact that Jonathan Pollard was a Jew, not the fact he's an American.
Yeah, Robert Levinson, who they've declared to be dead, it's you know who was the longest held American captive. He was, I think it was like the 90s or late 80s or so. Mm-hmm. He was captured in Iran and was held there. No, the Iranian government has never acknowledged it as such. Robert Levinson was a DEA agent, but he almost. Is there actual proof of this? No, but he almost certainly was a Mossad agent just by the way, by who's interested in securing his release and what he was doing over there. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's obvious he was a Pollard type.
Yeah, and Jonathan Pollard in an interview, of course, he flies back on Sheldon Adelson's plane, big donor to the Republican Party, Jewish donor to the Republican Party, and he's received like a hero in Israel. I made a point, I was at a family gathering, we were just discussing some of these things, and I talk about the Pollard case. And I go, he's received like a hero in Israel for betraying the United States to the Soviet Union. So how can Israel be our greatest ally?
Yeah. Well, and people who, you know, people who think I might be overdoing it, you explain that to me. You explain, like, what is it? What am I supposed to take from this exactly?
Yeah, why isn't
what is the lesson I'm supposed to derive from the pardoning of a convicted spy being flown over to Israel by the biggest Republican donor? What am I supposed to take from that?
And why wasn't Aldrich Ames pardoned? Why wasn't a Walker from the Walker Spiring pardoned? Or why wasn't like Robert Hansen pardoned? Well, they're not Jewish. You know, so I mean, there you go. And Jonathan Pollard interview just said that it's the duty of every Jew in the United States to be like him. He said that. So why is he pardoned? What's the base? He certainly isn't remorseful. You know, he's proud about it. You know, proud. You know, and the moment he was convicted, this began. But it, going back to the whole, you know, the court Jew thing, the court Juden thing, is the argument that, well, there's always powerful families above them. They're not the most powerful. That may well be true, you know, whether it's the black nobility, bankers, and these elite families and all that. But somewhere along the line, and this has happened particularly in the 19th century, you can point out in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars and the French Revolution, your Jewish emancipation. And so these traditional, you know, the age of republics and democracies, where you have, you know, confessional states collapsing, the monarchies collapsing, the end of Christian states. And so the idea we're all citizens, equal, Bill of Rights, Constitution, these things. So you have Jewish emancipation and Jews assume full rights within these countries, whether it's in France or in Germany, you know, or in England. Previously there were restrictions because there was acknowledged that they're a fifth column or alien group, and therefore from a practical sense, since they're not Christian and they're an alien group, they should be excluded from certain areas in life, whether it's certain trades or certain positions in government or power. Again, this is an anathema to today's thinking of, you know, of we're all equal citizens. It's considered bigoted and racist. But anyway, you know, the history of the Rothschilds and them, their political or financial ascendancy with the Battle of Waterloo, when Natty Rothschild shorts, I think, Bank of England stock under a false rumor that Napoleon had won the Battle of Waterloo. He uses that to amass a fortune and take over the Bank of England. And in the ensuing decades, his network throughout Europe, they became very powerful financially. And particularly like in England, they start to intermingle, commingle with the British aristocracy. The aristocracy itself had gone into debt because of their profligate ways. And so they start to become part of the establishment. And so by the 1870s, 1880s, there's a Jewish prime minister, Benjamin Disraeli, who has to seeks a loan from Lionel Rothschild to buy the Suez Canal because Parliament isn't in session and Parliament might not agree to it. But he has enough money to get together to buy the Suez Canal for the British. And there's a story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but it was in Niall Ferguson's book on the Rothschilds. But he says, Benjamin Disraeli is talking to his friend Lionel Rothschild and co-ethnic. And Lionel Rothschild says, "Well, what collateral do you offer for this loan?" And Disraeli turns to him and goes, "I offer you the British state." And so, so what extent was the British Empire, a Rothschild enterprise? And so this is the question. And then you have, throughout the 20th century, you have the sort of the cultural and political ascendancy of Judaism in the latter half, second half of the 20th century, particularly after the Second World War, when some also so the psychological and cultural barriers are leveled in the name of equal, democracy and civil rights. And you have the Declaration of Ethnic Warfare by the Jewish American, the American Jewish Committee with the authoritarian personality, the collapse of the production code. This has a lot to do with the demographic changes in the country, suburbanization, and there's a lot of history of this with urban renewal, ethnic warfare, the weakening of these Catholic ethnic groups, and the political decline of the Catholic Church in this era. And the cultural effect that it had with the Cultural Revolution, the legitimization of pornography, largely a result of Jewish agitation, Leo Pfeffer and these guys, the removal of prayer from public schools, again, Jewish agitation with the Schempp decision, again, Leo Pfeffer. So you have this example of Jewish ascendancy. And so at one point, maybe it was indeed they were the tail to the dog, but at some point, the tail begins to wag the dog. And so it changes. So you have the WASP elite and their power waxes and wanes, and you have Jewish elite wanes. So now there's been a switch. So as interesting as this history is about the court Juden and these elite families and Jews being excluded, well, perhaps in the ensuing 150 years, the roles have been reversed, or they've gained more power. Now it's a different situation.
I don't, yeah, the counter argument that, well, that they weren't the real power. If the argument is, well, Jews actually just waited, oh, Jews weren't actually in power. They were just like the servants. Well, okay, so they accrue the capital, they bided their time, and then they overthrew the people that they were once serving. I don't know. I don't know. I don't think this is the counter argument that whatever people are trying to make, that at some point they weren't literally like the kings of Europe. I don't think that's the powerful counter argument that some people think it might be.
And again, you have other things. Obviously, you have a historical, phenomenon like Illuminati or Freemasonry, which, again, if you look at it, it's very intertwined with the Jewish Kabbalah and all that. So what's the ultimate influence there? But the fact of the matter is we're where we are now, and focusing on Jewish organizations or Jewish power doesn't necessarily mean, again, you can't focus on other things. It's just,
I mean, like I find it very easy to focus on collapse and Jews at the same time. Sometimes they go. Sometimes it's actually quite easy for me to focus them on at the same time. But it's I always struggle with how to talk about this with people. I'm actually working on someone else right now. I tend to take a I plant seeds and then I kind of see what sprouts before I resume the process, because I think people try to come in too hard sometimes at in trying to talk about this stuff. Actually, since you mentioned the authoritarian personality, have you ever read Christopher Lasch's Haven in a Heartless World? It's actually there's a very funny so Christopher Lasch did a very one of a, this is actually one of his more academic books, analysis of the development of the nuclear family, basically. And from its origins as within the bourgeoisie. And he has a section actually on the Frankfurt School. And it's actually really funny to read because Lasch is not Jewish himself, and he analyzes what Adorno and I forget who the other one who co-authored it were saying, their about their F scale and what the authoritarian personality and all that. And Lash like puzzles over this, like it seems like they're just contradicting themselves in this work. It doesn't actually make a lot of sense, and it doesn't really hold up scrutiny to this analysis of where an authoritarian personality is supposed to derive from within the family. And he's doing this in a very gentle academic way, but it's really funny to read because he seems to be genuinely confused at how Adorno came to his conclusions and how and what their methodology was. Like, this doesn't seem to be a very sound methodology they're using here.
it's like looking at Kinsey's studies. Wait, this is wrong. It's like he's an agenda here or something. This isn't honest.
Yeah. Some of this stuff just seems to contradict each other. Did this person just not?
Well, because it was about power, and yeah. when all you're concerned about is gaining power, is you're willing to lie.
Yeah,
it's not a genuine analysis, and also it was a deep psychological because it's very Freudian, right? And the exploitation or the manipulation of, say, sexual passions by promoting pornography, and this with the was Eros and Civilization was about, and Wilhelm Reich was into this, where you study the psychological power of sexuality, and if you can get it at that, then you can overturn the Constitution without ever firing a shot, and that's what they've done in the 20th century. I mean, look at the confusion today, just brought about by sexual perversion or sexual immorality. It was E. Michael Jones who says that all of modernity is just rationalized for sexual misbehavior. It's just a rationalization for it, and it's an area of vulnerability. And attacking the nuclear family, obviously, you attack the sex. If you go where you attack it is sexuality, and in a sense, they are right. Is that a society where there's a strong family and with strong male role models, by their estimation, is fascist, by their understanding of it. It is fascist. It is authoritarian based on their understanding of things. So just like free speech is anti-Semitic. Now, what do you mean free speech is anti-Semitic? Well, based on their interpretation, because the moment you allow free speech, people are going to express their point of view on social media, on YouTube, and these various platforms about what they see. They'll talk about the problems of Jewish behavior and activism, and these things are going too far. And so inevitably, when people criticize Jewish organizations for their transgressions or their crimes, worth of promoting culturally, they'll interpret it as anti-Semitic. So inevitably, anti-Semitism based on free speech based on their understanding of anti-Semitism, which is just criticism of Jews, is anti-Semitic. So they got to suppress free speech, which is why you have things like repressive tolerance. Herbert Marcuse's idea of repressive tolerance. We tolerate radicalism on the left, but you don't tolerate the right. And so there's no principle here. It's about power.
Yeah, and right along that line, you have Karl Popper's paradox of tolerance, which is actually another one of those funny things where I see liberals. Of course, the only way that liberals can understand Popper's paradox of tolerance is through some really stupid humans of flat earth or wait, no, humans of flat design type cartoon that poorly explains it. Because if you actually read the Open Society and its enemies, it's anyone who's actually read it and who's not Jewish has always been perplexed by the arguments that Karl Popper makes in it, and especially for people who, I think even people who have never read Plato, because he's we know that he is a pillar of our civilization. There is just this innate sense that, well, Plato is good. Plato is very, Plato gave us many great ideas for us to think about, even if the average person doesn't understand what those ideas are. So when you read Karl Popper's book and he's attacking Plato and he's attacking these other philosophers, just like the Lash example, is like, what is he talking about? None of this makes any sense whatsoever. There's been actual academics that have tried to read Karl Popper's book, again, who aren't Jewish, and just don't understand where he's coming from on this. And there's been papers that have attempted to critique the Open Society and its foundations, and just because they don't understand it as a what it is a power document that seeks to undo the culture of the enemies of the person who wrote it.
Yes, yeah. And they'll talk, and when they're out of power, they'll talk about free speech and tolerance. But the moment they're in power, they'll suppress free speech as we see today. You know, and there was E. Michael Jones had a quote about this. He said, with the Jews in power, you know, abortion is a sacrament. You know, sodomy is a virtue. And pornography is free speech.
Yep.
And the idea is it's not a question. They create this idea of neutrality, you know, the naked public square. And this is what Leo Pfeffer, you know, who was a big advocate of free speech and the First Amendment, you know, getting the Bible out of public schools under the guise of First Amendment tolerance in the 1970s. And he was very successful. But what Leo Pfeffer talked about in his memoirs was growing up in New York City, and this would factor into the motivation behind a lot of his legal activism later on. I mean, he was a lawyer, was his hatred of, he would drive down the boulevard and see these lines of Catholic schoolgirls and boys lined up side by side in their, you know, the girls in their long plaid dresses and the boys in their white shirts and black ties and pants, trousers. And he just hated the idea of it. And he, such contempt he had for these people. And so, when you study like the psychology behind it, that's motivating. It's not a belief in principle of freedom and tolerance that's motivating his activism. He's destroying those people.
Yep.
He hates those people, and he hates you. You know, and that's you start to see all this stuff in a different light. It isn't. They're not there supporting freedom. They're not there supporting free speech because obviously they don't believe in it. Look what's happening now. Why does Facebook, you know, or Twitter have ADL and Southern Poverty Law Center, commissars policing speech and expression on these platforms?
And I think that's kind of the an undercurrent that I try to touch upon in my book, because it's a book, I think, for people who finally understand the meaning of try, but there's not a lot of stuff that often really speaks to that, because we still got these priors and this residue from a more ideological time, because that more ideological time was more homogeneous. Mm-hmm. Well, we're past that point now. We're in the time of tribe. And so once you have a tribal understanding, you have to have a tribal understanding of the problems at hand, all the different social problems, and have a refined sense of, you know, me versus the world. I mean, a good quote, I think, for people, especially in our milieu, to kind of, you know, brand upon their heart is the one that's associated with Saint Athanasius, that, you know, if the world is against the truth, then I'm against the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're seeing that now, because good example is recently there was a bill passed in Arkansas to restrict.
No, I heard about this Asa Hutchinson thing, right?
Yeah, there was a law that was pretty ban, you know, giving hormone treatments to minors, so-called sex reassignment surgery to minors. And Asa Hutchinson, the Republican conservative governor, vetoed the bill, saying it was too intrusive. He's a small government guy. So now you have this tactical libertarianism or tactical nihilism. So what are you talking about? It was just overridden today by the God, you know, bless their heart. The Arkansas legislature overrode the veto. Is that popular? And the vast majority, I mean, really, if you present this to the vast majority, they're going to reject this out of hand because it's just nuts. This whole idea of, I mean, whole the idea of reassignment surgery for adults is bad enough. It's you know, it's not something you should accept. But for children, it's a crime. If you were to watch the CNN or the news, how this is treated, you think you're the weirdo for not for supporting the veto or for supporting the law. But the Republican establishment came and get enough, find enough resolve to come out against this. They could really use this as a campaign. This shows you sort of how this is an oligarchic plan, because this is the oligarchs want this, because you get much more resistance at the political level to this insanity if it wasn't supported by powerful oligarchs.
Mm-hmm. I'm just looking into this Asa Hutchinson guy here. I guess it's not surprising what he did, considering he made a name for himself prosecuting the covenant, the sword, and the arm of the Lord, which I guess was a Christian identity group. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is, I guess it's not too surprising then that he's going to be a system toady.
Yeah.
And more so than the average Republican is, to be clear.
Yeah. And a lot of, like, you have Kristi Noem out in South Dakota, who again vetoed a law too. There's a law there protecting women's sports. Ironically, you know, you're the Title IX supposed to protect women's sports. Now you have the federal government destroying women's sports, allowing, you know, men who pretending to be women or boys pretending to be girls to swamp girls' sports programs. But again, she also vetoed the law saying, we're losing court. Well, let them beat you in court then. But she did it because under the pressure of the Chamber of Commerce. And also of Amazon. This goes to show you that what we're dealing with is a corporatocracy, is that the effect of governments are these corporations, because governments are the institutions that sort of make the rules and enforce the rules. And apparently, it's the corporations who are making the rules and enforcing them. And same thing with recently in Georgia with that, you know, with the voting law, you know, with Major League Baseball.
This is why I tell people to abandon the principles you think you have, because the principles were probably imposed upon you. Now, that doesn't mean become immoral. Morality and principle are two very different things. But more than likely, the principles you think you uphold, you need to examine that and see, were these principles that were imposed upon you, especially if you have a more conservative mindset. Just don't, you know, genuine conservatives. I wondered, because there is a certain level of there's a type of conservative that's very disingenuous and not, and just is not being honest with what they're doing. But there are genuine people who they actually believe in what could be called an American conservatism. And I would say to them, examine your actual principles here. Are these principles you actually believe and actually hold? Are these ones that were imposed upon you? Because if your principle causes you to keep losing over and over again, or you make the perfect the enemy of the good, then it doesn't seem like a very good principle. You have to, at some point, you have to fight, even if it's an imperfect weapon you're using.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the articles. This is the Associated Press, so whatever. Arkansas lawmakers on Tuesday made the state the first to ban gender-confirming treatments. Look at the gender-confirming treatments. That's what they call it, and surgery for transgender youth. Again,
Are they calling it gender affirmation yet? I wonder. I'm sure they are.
Yeah, or just the idea that there is such a thing as transgender. It's just, you know, this is a category they've created. Enacting the prohibition over the governor's objections. The Republican-controlled House and Senate voted to override the GOP Governor Asa Hutchinson's veto of the measure, which prohibits doctors from providing gender-confirming hormone treatment, puberty blockers, or surgery to anyone under 18 years old, or from referring them to other providers for the treatment. Opponents of the measure have vowed to sue to block the ban before it takes effect this summer. I'm sure they'll find a constitution right in the Constitution somewhere for this. Hutchinson vetoed the bill Monday following pleas from pediatricians, social workers, and parents of transgender youth who said the measure would harm a community, already at risk for depression and suicide. Oh, gee, I wonder why. The ban was opposed by several medical child welfare groups, including the American Academy of Pediatrics. The bill's sponsor dismissed oppositions from the medical groups and compared the restrictions on other limits to state places on minors, such as prohibiting them from drinking. Yeah, that makes sense. They need to get to be 18 years old before they make those decisions, Republican Robert Lindstrom said. Family Research Council praised the veto. Okay, override. That's typical. But the fact that we're at this point, where this is even controversial, I mean, really, you shouldn't be able to have a medical license if you're doing this to people, because it's mutilation. What's the point of having a professional licensing system or an association for medicine if doctors are allowed to act like these ghouls and mutilate people, take advantage of whatever psychological disorder they've suffered? You know, they're suffering.
Yeah. At this point, all I can tell people is they're probably not going to outright actually legalize pedophilia, but they will soft legalize it. And you could even argue that they've already done so. There's enough examples of it that's an argument that can be made that pedophilia has been soft legalized, but they're going to do it. And to people who I don't know who I'm talking to at this, but I mean, there are people who are obviously millions of people who are obviously unhappy about what's going on in this country and what they're doing. And at this point, it should be plainly obvious to anyone who's concerned about that the Republicans aren't going to do anything about it. The organizations and institutions that you think are advocating for you aren't going to do anything about it. So once they've soft legalized pedophilia, what now? What are you going to do? I guess that's the question I put out to people. What is your next plan? Now, my guess would be most people are just going to check out, and I understand why people do that, but. I mean, we're going to be living in a country where pedophilia has a soft legalization.
Well, they've already done with – I mean, they're doing it with entertainment.
Yeah.
I mean, I just – you know, I was at a Easter Sunday. We were lamenting with some of my family members, siblings, and in-laws about things, culture, and they're sort of a right-wing at a loss to understand it. And I said, well, you have to look at who is in control of the entertainment fair of the country. There are people producing the stuff that make the decision produces isn't just happening. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the ones raising kids. It's the same way that TV raised people. Now you have the internet and social media and this ubiquitous presence of just complete degenerate stuff. You know, you go from Elvis Presley to the Beatles to Marilyn Manson to this black guy who's the guy with the Satan's shoes or something. What's his name?
Oh, that little Nas X.
Yeah. Where is this?
He did that the Old Town Road rap song.
Okay, yeah, but at the same time, he's showing up on Sesame Street to entertain kids. Who's making that? This isn't an example of someone being absent-minded or going, "Oh, I didn't know. Sorry." No, this is overtly malicious. What does that tell you about the society in which you live in, the institutions which you still are nominally loyal to? I didn't say that because I'm sick of arguing on Easter Sunday with my family or Thanksgiving for that matter, or Christmas. They know where I stand on a lot of these things, but I kind of point this out. Says, well, look at Hollywood. I mean, we send our kids to college and to ruin our daughters, to drive them insane. And for that, we put them heavily in debt, you know?
I don't bring up my politics with friends or relatives, but I don't back down when politics is brought up with me. I don't go out of my way to make these things because I'm trying to navigate this world. And even though I have a better understanding than the average person, it's still difficult enough as it is to be able to navigate this society. But to me, it's not enough to be able to explain to people how the system works and what it's doing to you. And I hope this also comes across in my book. It's about having a certain self-confidence and moral courage within yourself as well, because, like I said, it's not enough to explain it. To me, I don't need to justify myself to the society, and I don't need to justify myself to anybody with power. They need to just – this world, this society, this country has to justify itself to me.
Yeah.
That's why I strongly urge people to internalize that if the world is against the truth, then you are against the world. And when it's not, that doesn't mean like running and hiding, although their, you know, tactical retreat is a tactic. It must be implemented when necessary. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to justify myself to the sick people who are going to soft legalize pedophilia or are going to stick their heads in the sand and allow it.
Yeah.
I as one person am powerless to do anything about it, and I'm currently stymied in any attempt to organize a resistance to it, though I'm building good bonds with people that I think will help us navigate the system. But at the end of the day, until I have a different path forward, all I can do is say justify yourself to me, because I don't have to justify myself to you.
To continue the insanity here, this is where it leads to. This is kind of, you can point some of the transgender stuff or other examples of degeneracy that create ridiculous situations you can point fun at and highlight the insanity of it all. One part, of course, from California. Men are coming 255 California prison inmates have requested transfer to women's prisons since January. Since January, 261 California prison inmates have requested transfers to prisons aligning with their gender identity, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation told the Daily Caller News Foundation Tuesday. Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom signed SB 132 into law in January, a bill that requires the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to ask every individual entering the department's custody to specify their pronouns, their gender identity, whether they identify as transgender, non-binary, or intersex. The law prevents CDCR from disciplining the individual if that individual refuses to give this information, allows for the information to be updated later on, and requires staff to use gender pronouns that the individual requested. It also requires that the CDCR house the individual, rather, in a correctional facility designed for men or women based on the individual's preference. Now, how do you have a prison for non-binary? Similar legislation has been passed in Connecticut and Massachusetts. Since the bill went into effect in January, 261 inmates have requested gender-based housing transfers. The CDCR told the Daily Caller News Foundation Tuesday. They have an acronym there. The vast majority of those requests were from inmates requesting to be transferred to female facilities. And only six inmates did not request to be in women's facilities. 255 are from transgender women and non-binary incarcerated people who are, I guess that's men who say they're women, okay, who are requesting to be housed in a female institution, and six are from transgender men, a non-binary incarcerated people who are requesting to be housed in a male institution, Deputy Press Secretary Terry Thornton told Daily Caller. CDCR has not denied a single gender-based housing request, the spokesman confirmed. CDCR has approved 21 of the requests. Four of these 21 have been transferred to Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. Prisoners fear that inmates requesting transfers are lying about their gender identity in order to be transferred. Oh, you think? I might do that. The LA Times reported this has been slowed down the transfer process. Now, how do you confirm someone's lying if it's so subjective? I mean,
I actually have their. Would you like to hear some from their FAA? Because I pulled this up. This is from the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and this is their Senate Bill 132 FAQ. Actually, it's funny when you look on the sidebar above Senate Bill 132 FAQ. There's the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which is there's a funny contrast here. So, who will decide? Okay, no, here's the is the placement to an institution in accordance with an incarcerated person's gender identity automatic upon their request? Now that goes through an approval process. However, could implementing this policy result in pregnancy? The possibility of pregnancy was considered in the development of this policy. CDCR has existing policies and procedures related to pregnancy. Sexual acts are prohibited in prison and will result in disciplinary action. Okay. All right, then that's – I mean, obviously we know they're doing bureaucratic language here. Is there a risk that cisgender men will falsely claim to be a transgender woman in order to be housed with women? CDCR has a multidisciplinary team of staff in place to review all gender-based housing preference requests, custody, medical, and mental health staff, as well as a PREA compliance manager will be involved in every assessment of a request to be housed in a facility that matches the person's gender identity. Will housing transgender women in a female institution put the safety of cisgender women at risk? CDCR's duty is to protect everyone within its facilities and takes that duty very seriously. Part of the review process for transgender people requesting housing based on their gender identity will include evaluation of the safety of the person making the request as well as the safety of the people at the facility where the person has asked to be housed. How does CDCR determine if an here's the kicker right here. How does CDCR determine if an incarcerated person is transgender? CDCR does not determine an incarcerated person's gender identity. Every incarcerated person self-identifies.
So there is no method, because there isn't it.
Clearly, though, Tim, they have to be on hormones, right? I mean, that's the very least you can ask,
yes.
Right? Are transgender people required to be on hormones? No, the decision whether or not to take hormones does not impact eligibility to be housed according to one's gender identity.
Okay, obviously, see, when you get so removed from reality, this is inevitable, right? Because if you're getting away from biological reality, dare I say the science of it, you enter in this insanity, because there's no way to, I mean, you're dealing with someone's fantasy or someone's delusion or claimed delusion or just lie. There's no basis in reality, and there's no policy basically to deal with this, because you can't have a policy, because basically it's, people are either male or female, you know, and that's how they should be housed.
Yeah.
Not how they say. What if they identify as a non-guilty person? They should be released. It's like
identify. Well, and on the top, you know, with biological reality, there is a sexual, there is a much different sexual reality for men versus women. If you look at rates of, you know, there's going to be more where men are involved. There's going to be more rape. That's just.
Oh yeah. So
there's literally nobody that would even dispute that if they have the capacity to think for 2 seconds.
So let's just say there's a convicted rapist, several convicted rapists housed in California detention centers. What if all those rapists now identify as women, and then they go into women's prisons?
And we're talking about a group of people that are going, even on hormones, are going to be, which they don't need to take, are going to be physically stronger than the women that they are housed with.
Yes. Yeah. But this is the insanity you enter in. This is piss earth. This is clown world.
And so like, any person who's not on board with us and wants to argue with me about it, again, I say to you, justify this to me. I don't need to explain myself. I don't need to twist myself up into knots. I don't need to be outraged about it. Beyond being outraged at this point. You explain this to me. You justify this to me.
How can the legislature in Massachusetts, Connecticut, California, how can you take them seriously at this point? I mean, other than their power to mess your life up, but I'm saying is obviously they're insane, or they're passing obviously insane legislation just for discordian purposes. I mean, they're acting as agents. Now, I think we know the usual, because people have done books. There is a book I'm looking at right now called The Transgender Industrial Complex, published by your publisher, I think.
Great book.
And this names the names and organizations. There is a powerful network supporting this insanity. This isn't just out of the blue. A lot of money behind this. And, of course, you know, our current Assistant Secretary of Health, mental health, you know, is allegedly is transgendered. He claims to be. Rachel Levine, formerly Richard Levine. And he's in as the Assistant Secretary of Health, he oversees the country's health, it's mental health institutions, it's funding and all that. And obviously this is someone who's not, if he's not malevolent, he's insane. But he got approved by the Senate for this position, despite the fact that he's wearing a dress pretending to be a woman. And not only does he say he pretends to be a woman, he demands that you pretend that he's a woman. You know,
there's nothing that can convince me that humiliation is not the underlying principle behind why they do this.
That's what it is. And what I mean, and he gets 51 votes in the Senate.
Yeah, you know?
He shows up in a dress, and people are criticized Rand Paul for having the temerity to just ask him questions and not show him respect.
Yeah, the most asking the most tepid of questions, because yes, this is another thing. I want people to orient themselves the correct way when they attack this stuff, because there's this impulse to throw even Republicans, when they seem to be doing a good job, to throw them a bone. Like, well, at least Rand Paul says something. No, if where you're starting from is, well, we're fine with transgenderism. What you do is your own business. We just don't want you going at the children. Then you've already lost. You're already engaging in a rear guard action. That's all you're doing, and I'm not going to give you credit for that.
What you need publicly, and just normally people just have shared utter contempt and disgust for someone like that. I mean, it's, I guess you could say, if they're doing it their own, on their own, and they're on the street, and you're going, ooh, look at that person. They don't want to have any position of authority over people. You can arguably go, well, it's him, and it's not, it's benign. It's, as long as he doesn't prey on anybody or commit any crimes. But he's giving a position of authority to control the where the money goes for research, oversee these things. He's advocated the very thing that was banned in our Arkansas by the legislature. They had the decency to override the veto. But this is child abuse. This is mutilation. This is, it is the equivalent of genital mutilation. At least Rand Paul did say that. But the end of the day is, I would focus on is, why do you think you're a woman? You're obviously not. I mean, it might be, I should be forgiven to think you're deluded, and in fact, you're deluded. You suffer from this delusion, this narcissism, whatever it is. You shouldn't be given a position of authority over people, or control over mass, or the taxpayers' funds, or organization, which has a lot of coercive power to advocate these things. He's a malevolent force. But this goes back to the fact that, we're at a stage now. It was a time 40, 50 years ago, people would dismiss this and be disgusted with, and that's a healthy reaction. Mike Enoch made a point. He said that either you're going to call these people disgusting fags, or you're going to have to put up with transgenderism. And what he meant by that is, either you're going to have this visceral, natural reaction to disgusting immoral behavior, or if you start to accept it and be polite with it, it's going to expand. It's going to increasingly demand acceptance and approval and promotion, which is where we are today.
There's no such thing as tolerance in the society. Tolerance is just the first step towards consolidation of power, and that's so. Whenever anyone tries to do any kind of libertarian type arguments, or what they think is a conservative argument about, sanctity of individual freedom or what have you, it's like, no. Tolerance is literally just a way of allowing the other tribe to consolidate power while they work on eroding yours. Everything is inter-ethnic or intergroup competition. That is not that, that just fundamentally cannot change. And so you have to get people to thinking towards that.
Yeah, and deviancy is a constant. Every society has an idea of deviancy. It's just a question of what's considered deviant, and it's a question of whose values prevail. That's this myth of neutrality. It's one of the things. This is the tyranny of moral relativism, where moral relativism first gives the impression that it's neutral, that it's not imposing any values on that. But once you surrender, or you abdicate the idea of objective morality or objective truth, those with the power to impose their own idea of truth become the powerful. They're not subjected to any higher law, be it God or the truth, or truth with a capital T. And so it's those with the power. We're back to Thrasymachus, and power. Truth is the power, is the opinion of the powerful, and that's where we are today. That's when once you start to, surrender these objective categories, like 2 + 2 = 4, or men are men, women are women. Men have penises, women have vaginas, and never the twain shall meet except in Congress. These are separate categories that complement each other. And this is a reality of nature. It's nature's binary. But once you surrender these truths, you have anarchy. But really, you don't have anarchy. What you have is you have tyranny, because those with the power, who no longer acknowledge objective reality or morality, because they're above it. So it's just a way to impose a tyranny, and it's just a
Yeah,
question of someone's values prevailing.
Moral relativism is just the smokescreen for the moral minority. That's all it is. And I mean, I believe I subscribe to a natural, to the natural law, to the true morality. But if someone were to try to drag me into some asinine debate, I probably wouldn't be able to formulate the most powerful, unassailable argument as to why my morality is the true morality. But my morality is my morality. I think by con on a consequential level, looking at it, it's a healthy morality. But at the end of the day, I want my descendants to overrun the earth and to be more powerful than the other tribe's descendants, and I'm not going to justify that. That's how it is. That's what everybody else does. That's how it works.
Well, they've tricked I guess you could say normal people into thinking that no, we're all everyone will be equal. We all play by the same rules. We all accept these rules, regardless of demographics or ethnic background. It's ideas that matter. There's an interesting program I saw on YouTube recently. I forget the name of it, but it was talking about the libertarian. I guess I forget the title of it. Basically, how libertarians become alt-right.
Oh, well, yeah, one of those like here's how the alt-right actually argues or what have you type videos.
But what it was interesting, he made the point here. He's talking about the idea of America being a propositional nation, ideas, and he begins with discussing polling data on people's ideas about things that matter to them, particularly political questions like the First Amendment, freedom of speech, size of government, taxes, and of course the people that are poll the most right wing or conservative on those are ethnic white Americans. And some of the idea about immigration, these things is as more people of color come into the country, is they come from countries where these people don't have these ideas, don't have these propositional ideas of America, Bill of Rights, First Amendment, freedom of speech, these things. And so some say, well, that's a problem because they won't have these same values, and that's going to change the politics of the country. And so he says, well, when they first come to the country, they when you poll them, these people of color do not support things like, the First Amendment or the Second Amendment, or nor are they skeptical of government, or are they skeptical. They're big for big welfare, high taxes, and these things. And they've done studies where two, three generations into this, they're still very much in favor of big taxes. They don't give much support or care much about the First Amendment or the Second Amendment or freedom of speech and these things. So the idea is that the America is a propositional nation. It can only be a propositional nation if the demographics stay the same or maintain a strong white majority. So a
I mean,
propositional country is an ethnic white country.
I would argue that the propositional idea of America is a myth anyways. I don't think you can escape that there is a spiritual aspect to race, that race is real, race is a feeling, and it's not just about ideas, it's not just about policies, because we've seen, there wasn't that's an old argument in terms of like, here's why, trying to like explain to Republicans, like, why are you advocating for immigration? The people who you want to emigrate here don't share your ideas. And not only do are Republicans well aware of that, I think they're banking on the other side of it, which is they don't. What ends up happening is they're just going to make those people continue to make those people anti-white and gay. That's they're going to ultimately, being that they're, especially Hispanics, being that a lot of them are alpha consumers, they're going to basically just uphold the neoliberal system and be its functionaries if that system continues to provide them with a punching bag, which is white people, and endless crass entertainment, which they have no problem eating up. The level which that the complete degradation and destruction of our culture has turned large swaths of people into absolute system loyalists is actually quite astounding.
Yeah, it's amazing what people will do for crumbs, right?
Not even crumb, like the, not even crumbs, like the simulation of a crumb, if anything.
it's the problem is that I mean, it goes back. If you go, people crave their comforts, and their breads and circuses, and so they'll do anything to maintain that, and so they're not going to go out on a limb and take a risk. And that's something where, for the longest time in America, you could pretty much buy yourself out of the problems. You can move away, right? You could live in a gated community. You could go to a neighborhood that has good schools, in quotes, as they say, and escape, the enrichment that the elite were imposing on the country. That seems to be closing now, and that's something that maybe the events of last year woke a lot of people up to. At least I'd like to think that what was going on. the whole thing we have right now, there's a trial for, Officer Chauvin in Minnesota. They've done polling data, and I think it was as high, more than 7% of whites think he's innocent, meaning that George Floyd did not die at the hands of Derek Chauvin. He died of a drug overdose, but the facts seem to suggest that. But then they take a poll of like blacks, the majority of them think he was killed by the cops. So that, they're not willing to look at any of the evidence. It's broken down along tribal lines,
Imagine having to justify yourself to a country where a significant portion of the population thinks that somebody who was boofing fentanyl right before he died is it was not at all culpable for his own death.
Well, that's the lumpen proletariat that they've produced, and that you're familiar with the idea of Biolenism, right?
And I believe it was Spandrel that came up with it. I don't usually use the term. I understand the idea behind it. I don't think it's necessarily, it's not a wrong idea. I just don't, I think it has a limited scope idea, but it is, I think it is useful for explaining some of the stuff to people. What it gets to is that ideology doesn't matter, that ugliness is an actual value that they're cultivating in people, and people are willing to fight to the death for their own ugliness.
But the whole, I like the whole strategy of sort of targeting the middle, the top, using the bottom to squeeze the middle is an interesting concept. That I think it's pretty self-evident that's what's happening. I mean, when you see Black Lives Matter being enriched with corporate funding, or Antifa, just being allowed to operate unobstructed, by the FBI, just ignoring that it exists, it's just an idea. At the same time, they're going after white supremacists, which is really just left, right of center white Americans with conservative, moderate conservative, conservative politics.
And the idea of the high and the low attack in the middle, that's something that Bernard de Jouvenel also expounds upon in his works as well. There's Imperial Press has a good book on this called Nemesis, where Jouvenel basically he's got that for people who are very oriented more towards system type thinking. It's a great analysis of that, moving away kind of from some of the more. And this, I know, because this is a problem my own writing has as well. Moving away from some of the more meme speak type things that a lot of our essays tend to be infused with.
But what it suggests, just a lot of people aren't willing to see what's happening. Because my question is when you're in the middle of a revolution, do you identify it as such? Right now, it seems to be the typical American, the heritage American, is being crushed between the hammer revolution, the anvil of tyranny, and the system is the. It's not as if the. There is a insurgent group that's seeking to seize power. Is those that are in power are waging the revolution. It's the corporation. That's why all this. Why would Amazon, or NCAA, or special professional sports programs, come out so hardcore, be such strong advocates for transgenderism? Other than what are they trying? Further atomize society. I mean, what could be their objective in this, or to come out against a tepid voting integrity law in Georgia, just a law that requires people to produce an ID to vote, being called worse than Jim Crow, and Coca-Cola Company.
The benefit of advocating for transgenderism, this is probably the favorite word I've ever coined. It creates tranitaries because they'll be fiercely loyal to the system that advocates for them.
Ah, yes, because no, that's the only power they have is the backing, which is, I think, part of Biolenism, if I understand it. Yeah, is
Yeah, no, yeah.
the
Basically, the idea behind Biolenism is that you take the word, like the word. So when I say the word ugly, I mean that both physically and spiritually and every which way. You take these people who would not have any power under what basically any normal human expression of a system, and they're empowered to basically be its enforcers. And because this is the only way they'll ever be given power, they are going to be fiercely loyal to the system that gives them that power over, well, the non-ugly.
Yeah, but this also takes us back to the authoritarian personality. is again, and the sort of this the weaponization or the idea of sexual liberation as political control that E. Michael Jones writes about, is you excite the passions, you release this power, and you can upend the civilization, what Wilhelm Reich talked about doing in Mass Psychology of Fascism. But the idea, the strategy, goes back. I mean, you can, again, when we talk about these things to people, normal people, normies, is you can chart out the organizations, sort of the patterns, the history, and the things that they've done throughout the years to carry out the cultural revolution that we're now experiencing. But I think it
Well,
was in.
that's actually why I wrote that McGulag essay within for this book, because the problem I realized is we live under by the actual definition of oppression, by any actual definition of oppression, we live under an oppressive system. But the average person doesn't think they live under an oppressive system because they only have media ideas of what an oppressive system looks like. And so I wrote that essay to try and explain to people this is what oppression actually like. This is like li by in any reasonable definition, this is an oppressive system. This is what it looks like. You have to abandon this media idea you have because you live under under an oppressive
Yeah,
system.
this is what you're right. It's not the jackboot thugs, it's not the trains, cattle cars, and it's not the barbed wire, which is the aesthetics of tyranny that we're used to. It's this. I think that's how you word it in the essay. At least that's a I remember that essay. Yeah. Where
Yeah,
it
because
isn't
I present two
North Korea.
scenarios.
Yeah. And good example of that, I was talking to a sibling of mine, and he was talking about his experiences at work, and he's in a corporate setting, and he's talked about some of this, I guess you could say, sensitivity, toleration training that they have to go through. And he's at a meeting, and someone says, "Well, I'd like to have, want some honest comments here." And he says, "Well, I'm not going to say anything." And no one says anything. You better not say anything. You just go along. He says, "Well, this that condition may not be slavery, but it certainly isn't freedom." I mean,
It's literally oppression.
it's oppression. If you feel.
I mean, like we're especially if you have like a conservative bent, you kind of instinctively have a revulsion towards words like conditions being oppressive or intolerable because you don't want to think of yourself as being under that, especially because of how abused the word is by liberals. That's not you. It feels like it almost feels wrong to say, "Oh, I'm being oppressed. Oh, the situation is intolerable because of the way." But that's the thing is like there's this movie called Kung Pao Enter the Fist, and there's a scene where it gets a parody of kung fu movies, and the master of the school says, "You, I must apologize for this other character. We trained him wrong as a joke." And that's for people with a conservative and traditional bent. Like sometimes that's how we were taught to look at things. But look at the actual oppression, the actual definition of oppressive. It means to unjustly inflict hardship and constraint on a subordinate group. Well, that's what we are. That's what the situation is. What does it mean to be intolerable? It means the situation is impossible to be tolerated. Well, that's the situation we're under. So the words oppressive and intolerable are the only way you can actually explain it. You have to abandon this instinctive like feeling, the feeling of wrong feelings. Like, no, that's not me. It's like, no, it is you. It is you. That's the situation. You are afraid to speak. I don't know what else to call that other than oppressive and intolerable.
Yeah, and despite the fact that the company has nothing to do with any political issue, so why is this even relevant to our mission here? So you can't even fall back on that, saying that I just want to go to work and do my job and not think about politics. You can't even get away from it, because then they throw it at you, whether it's making you wear a rainbow shirt on Friday in June, or supporting black, coming out in support of Black Lives Matter, or speaking up against anti-Asian hate for a couple of days, because that's the media made it a sensation for a couple of days for whatever reason, and even if you expressed not just not support, saying I don't want to talk about it, you'd be targeted, you know. But and that is oppression. Yeah, I'm afraid to speak for fear of retribution. But of course, that's oppression.
This is why The Power of the Powerless by Havel, the Czech dissident, is actually really well worth reading, because he called the ideology of communist Czechoslovakia in the 1970s the post totalitarian system, or the post totalitarian ideology, because the way he outlines it, he has a famous example of the greengrocer that has to put signs that say "Workers of the World Unite," and this greengrocer doesn't actually care one way or the other about it, but he knows he has to do it. He outlines how eventually that situation becomes just intolerable to the greengrocer, and he may speak out, and he'll have the full weight of the system crush him. But that system includes the people, includes basically everyone who exists within it, because with the conditioning they're under, people become the system themselves because they reify it. But the thing is, like, you have to pass through that one way or the other. It gets to a point where people have to live within the truth. And as difficult as that is, you'll feel a lot better once you're able to figure out how you cope with that situation. But for a lot of people, it just, you're not going to be able to be quiet. And the best, instead of snapping in a destructive way, it's better to develop a way of, how do I deal with this reality that I'm in?
When I read that essay, I just thought to myself, I'm glad I don't live in a communist country.
What was the thing that the paleocons used to say, that the Cold War was a civil war between the Trotskyists and the Stalinists, and the Trotskyists won?
Yes, and that's I think a lot of truth to that. But what I was saying, getting back with the idea of the creating tranisaries, you can create a cadre, a generation of them, as we're seeing rates of homosexuality increase, and you can increase that. Because it is, it's epigenetic, it's epiphenomenal, meaning you create the conditions for psychosexual confusion. You're going to have more of these, you know, damaged people. And this was foreseen in the authoritarian personality. Obviously, you break up the family by attacking the father, and then everyone becomes atomized and weak. It's weak. The host culture becomes weaker, and it's easier for said ethnic group to succeed in, because they fear strong ethnic identity. Later on in the 60s, you had there was a meeting in Pennsylvania, I think, with the U.S. Population Council, Planned Parenthood, sponsored by the U.S. government. And this is funny, because it's part of the population control issue. It involves sexual corruption to reduce the population. But there's the Burleson Jaffe memos, and this was this meeting that was conducted. And of course, I think both Dr. Burleson and Jaffe were Jewish too. And so there's another, again, pattern there. But it discussed openly, you might have heard about this, it discussed openly how do we affect the population pattern in the United States. What it came down to, and it came down to, is promoting sexual confusion and promoting things like, well, one thing is to promote homosexuality by promoting family breakup, dissolution, and divorce, because you create the very conditions where children are abused, and more likely, in response to that abuse or trauma, you develop psychosexual problems, one of which is some homosexuality. And you promote things like sex among old people. And then, of course, we have Viagra, the media. And you promote sexual imagery to young people, sex education in the schools, and these things. Remember, sex education was originally promoted as a way to address the problem of teenage pregnancy, when the rates were like in the single digits. And since they started addressing the problem, it's quadrupled. You know, it's almost like the DARE program, where they tell people about drugs to encourage it. And the same thing with sex education in the schools, promoting
don't do this cool drug.
Exactly. Yeah. But so here you have this the U.S. government is conspiring to corrupt the morals, weaken the family to affect population patterns. the primary target of which is the America's white majority, which then was like 85, close to 90%. Now it's down to 62%. The subsequent to that, you had in the 1980s and 90s, under the guise of age education, you had the U.S. government again meeting with Russell Sage Foundation, of the Department of Health and Human Services, to promote age education, and they have the memos to this, and is how it was openly discussed how the focus of this of age education, basically more graphic sexual material we presented to kids under the guise of protecting from getting AIDS, and so, but within these memos, they admit that the focus isn't so much on health and promoting health. It's there to change the values of the students, the sexual mores and values of the students, and these programs would otherwise be heavily objected opposed by the parents. But you put the scare of AIDS into them with the idea that we're all going to get AIDS, then these programs would be allowed. But the objective again was not to avoid getting AIDS. It was there to change the sexual values of the students. So you have open, open malevolence doing this, but all this is targeting. They're creating these Trannaseries through these programs. And we're seeing that today now, that's sort of the product of 50 years of this stuff, at least in the country.
Yeah, and it's if there's one thing that my book was a little bit critiqued for, and I don't disagree with it, is what do people do about it? And I don't really have an answer other than, you have to develop a certain moral courage. You have to create strong bonds, and you kind of, I mean, I guess it's like a ride the tiger type thing that people need to do, because at this time, I don't know. I frankly don't know what we do about it. And you can talk to people and point out what's going on, and if they understand, a lot of them are going to understand. They may The only thing they may take from this is like, okay, I just got to hide my head in the sand a lot deeper now because I didn't realize it was that bad.
Yeah, which doesn't really solve the problem, and nor is it a responsible adult response to the threat. Your job is there to protect your kids, to do what you have to do, or whatever you can do to. I mean, there's the Serenity Prayer, right? Yeah, Lord, give me the strength to identify the things I can change, that I cannot change, and and so you can identify the things you can change and deal with it, and things you cannot change, you move away from. But at the very least, you the ability to identify these things and then be effective. I mean, I think in our before we started recording, you talked about how your house is now being adorned with traditional Catholic. Am I revealing too much? I'm
No,
sorry.
that's fine. I mean, people know about kind of about
Okay.
that. No, the white wife has gone like she's leaned into being an Irish Catholic very hardcore.
Okay.
Not, of course, not a bad thing whatsoever, but it does amuse me with once she gets into something, it's from 0 to 100. So.
Yeah, everyone, like I said, everyone has to be a member of a cult. It's a question of joining the right cult.
Yeah,
That's
I've told people this that
yeah.
like you I well, the way I phrase it is like culture community, you have to choose one of them.
Yeah, I mean, they'll say no, be the individual. That's the devil lying to you. That's saying break it. Yeah, then you're naked before the state. You've no one to back you up, both physically and emotionally. But so I mean, that's probably as things unwind or develop. Is forming the sense the attempt to form community is very important, not just for your own physical safety, but for your own emotional, health and spiritual health. There's an example in Poland, which is still very an ethnically based country, heavily Catholic, and it was there that they turned back the tide of transgenderism, homosexuality, gay marriage. And it was done specifically through the offices of the Catholic Church there, because there the church is still strong, and they had an institution to fight this. And for the time being, they kicked it out, they stopped it. And you have some efforts, even in Hungary, that's spotty, from what I understand, but still ethnic identity in these things. So th this is perhaps areas where you can make a stand, or if you don't have it, try to. Reinvigorate or create it. It's difficult in the United States because we're so, I mean, it's such a, a diverse, pluralistic society. The way you, and this goes back to its founding ideas and origins, which you alluded to earlier, is perhaps the whole experiment of this Enlightenment idea of liberalism itself is heavily flawed. And so it's bad anthropology, it's bad philosophy, and it's bad theology. And I think, I forget, maybe it was Leo XIII that said that I guess all problems can be laid at the feet of a theological mistake.
Yeah,
So.
and does not necessarily, and the theology does not necessarily have to be actual theology. It could be political theology.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it was Carl Schmitt wrote that book, right? All ideas
Yep.
are theological, and yeah, because even the, even the self-professed atheist pushing ideology is in a way pushing a theology, his view, his vision of the universe and the world, he's imposing it upon you, you know.
Society on a certain level is taken on faith, and you have faith in the society that you live in. The real question is going to be, and I think we're moving towards that. So the real question is going to be, what happens when a supermajority does not have faith in their own society?
Well, that isn't hasn't that been the project since at least 1963 in this country?
Well, I mean, they want, I mean, they,
Yeah.
but they, the people who are in charge want us to like, to, they want us to like the system on some level, or at least be acquiescent to the system. But when, and there's, they have enough little rabbit holes and fake factions for you to join and to pretend to be patriotic and to consider this country to be the, the shining city on the hill where anybody can come here and make an honest, live the American dream, achieve the American dream, and make, live it, work an honest day's work and get an honest day's pay, and do make sure your kids do better than you did. They still have enough people that are invested in some level on that, that theological narrative. But my question is, what's in it? Because I think we're hurtling towards that. My question is, what happens when a supermajority doesn't even have faith in that?
Perhaps we're finding out.
Yeah, no, I think we're gonna find out one way or the other. That's like, I mean, I guess I keep trying to bring it back to the book, on some level, but like that's the question to me. Like that's the big question that kind of looms over my book is, we're going to be going into that situation no matter what. So what do we do? How do we interpret it? And what's that going to look like exactly?
Yeah, I think we're in a revolutionary period, and that's what we saw since I think it started, I think, with the whole COVID stuff in February or March of last year. And then I don't think it was just a coincidence that you had the riots in May and the George Floyd incident and these things, and this create the this the whole pandemic thing created the conditions for the election debacle and all the fraud, and you had essentially a coup. And you had the installation of a brain dead president, which is perfect for them now. The presidency is largely irrelevant because you're just, I mean, they're just figureheads at this point. It's obvious he's not doing anything. And so they, again, this goes back to not having any confidence in institutions. This is sort of the double bind, perhaps. You can, be disgusted at Joe Biden and the joke of the administration and all the corruption, but then again, then you lack all confidence in your institutions and your country, and it's ripe for some sort of, collapse or takeover. What the end game is there, but whether they'll see, on the other hand, it could be, again, this is where they go too far, they expose too much, and they get something they didn't really anticipate, and that could be the radicalization of the what is up there now, sort of a hapless and atomized white ethnic majority, and maybe that's, where they're headed now with some all this rhetoric. But I don't think you're gonna get like a national, like a Turner Diary scenario, at least not in the United States, because you don't have a. Na it's not gonna ha happen on a national level. I think it will break down to regionalism, perhaps. But again, who knows?
Yeah, well, that's kind of my view. I mean, I'm a big believer in that the United States is collapsing, that we've been in a collapse. Collapse is a process. It's not going to be one of those situations where we will look out our windows one day and realize we're living in Mad Max land. I mean, For some of us, actually, we already are. If you live in some American cities, you can look at your. It's just that our Mad Max world is a lot darker than, like, racially a lot darker than the way that media depicts it.
Yeah,
but it's already kind of happened on some level with that, but. There's going to be this coming apart, and there will be a rump state, United States, that will insist on the fiction that it's the United, that is the, it is the contiguous United States of America, and those regions that they have no control over. Well, they're still under our control. It's fine. The good times are just around the bend again. We temporary setback.
Yeah, it's hard to say. Cause I remember, I'm old enough to remember the late 1970s, and sort of the pessimism and despair that people felt at that time, after coming off after Vietnam and Watergate and the economic problems, and then you had the revival in the 80s under Reagan. But you know, the demographics were different then, so you could have sort of a relapse or a revival. But I it's hard to see how this plays out now.
They've gotten pretty good at well, at least they've been able to do it twice, of creating the semblance of a dead cat bounce, basically, with the 1980s, and then what they were doing with the war fever and the war pitch in the aughts. But they're getting diminishing returns on this, and they tried to do another dead cat bounce with the Trump administration, but there was already too much discord it's not going to be a time period. So the 80s resonated very hot, very well with a huge swath of the population. The aughts was a very diminished form of that, and the Trump era is going to be an even more diminished form of that. So every bounce has gotten lower and lower in terms of its peak point. So they have not been able to capture a lot of that 1980s energy as much as people pine for it, which just that tells me the decline is it's unavoidable. Things can always change. Like if you look at the analysis of any kind of collapsing empire, Rome in had the crisis in the 3rd century, and it was able to hobble on and actually kind of like start to put itself back together for quite some time before it finally fell back apart permanently. So there's no deterministic value to this. If there was an actual will to, they could halt a lot of this stuff, but there's no political will to, so this is the path we're on right now.
Yeah, I think the elite now have decided, at least they want to just, you know, kind of crush what remains of Heritage America. That's the only way you can look at what's going on now, you know.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there'd be some pushback. So, oh well. Okay. So we'll come up more close to 2 hours. So the book, where do you want people to get it?
AntelopeHillPublishing.com. If you're in the United States, I would ask that people buy it directly from the publisher, AntelopeHillPublishing.com. There is an ebook version. I actually got this question a couple of times. It's you just look carefully on the book page for it. There is a link to an ebook version. Now, if you're not in the United States, then I think it's still on Amazon. You can go ahead and use Amazon to get it. At least the last time I checked, it was still on Amazon. But if you're in the United States, I highly encourage just go for the publisher. Try to cut Amazon out of the profits as much as possible. On some level, it's unavoidable. I get that, but you know, let's try to practice what we preach as much as possible here.
Yes.
What I wanted to ask you, because it seemed like did you enjoy my book?
Oh yes, yeah, enjoyed it wonderfully. Yeah.
Were there any particular essays? I guess this would be like a recommendation for your audience. Were there any particular essays? Because some people will read it straight ahead. Some people jump around a little bit. Were there any particular essays you really enjoyed?
Yeah, the Piss Earth one. I particularly like the McGulag. I like that. The observation was particularly insightful about the idea.
That was probably my favorite. Outside of the essay I wrote for my son, which is the end of the book.
Yeah.
That was McGulag was probably my favorite of the new essays I wrote.
And it was Piss Earth and the one Humiliation.
Oh yeah, Feast of Shame. Yeah, that's
Feast of
that's
Shame.
the that's the classic one. That's the one that got me a wife. She read that email, contacted me, and that's well.
And
Here we are.
I read this. I don't get down or depressed or despair because that's what the devil wants us to do. These are rallying points in the way I look at it. All this nonsense with transgenderism, the racial stuff, the anti-white stuff, even the all this COVID stuff, the fake pandemic and the lockdowns, this is an opportunity the Lord has given us to be great. And I don't mean that in a sort of a megalomaniacal sense. I mean to stand up for something, to fight for something. Otherwise, they could have kept it going for a while, and we'd just be happy in our mediocrity, but this is a chance to do something, to stand up and fight for something. And that's the way of the world. I mean, you got to fight for things. The world's full of monsters. That's our job as fathers is to kind of instruct our children, particularly our sons, that this is a reality. And for the longest time, people have been living in a fantasy, that these things don't exist, that we don't have enemies. I mean,
it seems like a good point for us to head out, especially because I'm assuming you could hear it. Yeah, it looks like the dog is
there you go.
wanting some attention. So the dog has declared that there's nothing else for us to talk about. Yes, antelopehillpublishing.com. Everyone check that out.
Yeah, that is Cultured Grugs, Dispatches from America in Collapse. Of course, you are the host of Third Rail and also the People Square, which are two programs on the Right Stuff Network. So
yep.
Thanks a lot.